Hi, I'm Özgür. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at Penn State and also a member of CNEU, and we'll be talking about nanotechnology solar cells. So, here we start. This is a part of the lecture series on nanotechnology in solar cells, and the first lecture will cover the optics in solar cells. So we'll start with the definition of light, and then we'll look into the light absorption in these solar cells. And then we'll investigate all these different scenarios when light interacts with matter. Okay, let's start with light. When we ask the question what light is, the first thing that comes to our mind will be the white light source that we have in our homes everywhere. As you can see, light is composed of different wavelengths, and here we're seeing some of these different wavelengths. Light is composed of all these different colors that are visible to us. We name these colors as red, orange, and all the others. As you can see, light is strikingly does have a wave function. It's in a wave form, and it's some of these waves have a smaller wavelength, and the others, on the contrast, have a larger wavelength. So we started talking about waves. And the first thing that will come to our mind will be the ocean waves. As you can see, as the waves approach to the shore, their wavelengths, here designated with these lambda, are getting shorter. The waves that we're going to be investigating are similar, but they're governed by different physics. The acoustic waves also propagate with pressure, just like the waves in the ocean. In contrast, the waves of light, the electromagnetic waves, have an electromagnetic expression, and they're a little different. And as you can see, the wavelength is defined from peak to peak, and we'll be using that in the next slides. Okay, so here's the light. What do I mean by an electromagnetic wave? Well, basically, an electromagnetic wave is composed of an electric field component and a magnetic field component. Well, B is just related to magnetic field, so in the time being, you can just think of it as a H field, the magnetic field. We'll talk about this in the further slides. So, wavelength, again, is defined from peak to peak here, distance between two successive peaks, and the frequency is defined like this. If you're talking about a wave function, then you will immediately have a frequency related to that wave function. And the multiplication of these two variables, lambda and f, will bring you a constant, c, which is the speed of light in this case, when light is propagating in vacuum. And of course, then you can define the energy of these wave packets, which is defined as the Planck constant times the frequency. Well, if you just multiply two sides by 2 pi and divide it by 2 pi again, then you arrive at this expression here. And the omega, which is the angular frequency. That's also another definition of energy. Okay, let's start talking about the scales when we talk about waves. Radio waves. Radio waves, as you can see, Their wavelengths are in the order of kilometers, and this makes them easier to propagate and cover large distances. Human beings, our scale is over there. Microwaves, as you can see, they have a wavelength of 1 centimeter or so. As we go along, it gets shorter. And of course, then we will switch it to the frequency domain here. Frequency is always represented with hertz. 10 to the 4 is 10 kilohertz, whereas 10 to the 12, which is the main interest for us, is defined as terahertz. As you can see, the visible range, which is appealing to our eyes, are here, and the wavelength corresponding to that range has a dimension that's close to the bacteria that we can see around, so it's pretty small. Before we further ado, let me introduce you to one remarkable person, James Clerk Maxwell. What did he do? Well, he formulated that light is an electromagnetic wave for the first time. And these are the famous four equations that he gathered. I won't be bothering with these complicated equations, but it's enough for you to know that these are Maxwell's equations. And what did he do? Well, 150 years ago, James Clerk Maxwell related E, here the electric field, to B, and magnetic field, H, to D. Let's see what those are. Okay, as you can see, D and B are somewhat related to E and H, but we won't be, again, using this complicated equation. Instead, our complicated equations will be boiling down to this rather simpler equation, in which D and E are linearly expressed in terms of each other, and just likewise B and H are so. So, as you can see, we have different constants here. Epsilon zero is the permittivity of free space, vacuum basically. And lambda zero here is the permeability of the free space. These other constants here, epsilon r and mu r, are the relative permittivities and permeabilities. Well, this relation is only true for bulk material, isotropic media, which will be our main interest in the following slides. Okay, what do we mean by isotropic media? An isotropic media is defined when all of the phase velocities, or the speed of light in all these different axes, x, y, and z, are equal to each other. In the simplest case, vacuum, as you can see, light travels with the same speed, c, in all directions. And epsilon r and mu r, the relative permittivity and permeability, are equal to 1. Okay. Let's keep the Maxwell's equations in our mind. If we have some sort of a wave, this is a rather simplification again. What are we doing here? We are dividing the field vectors, the electromagnetic waves, into two parts. The part that's related to the position, and the part that's related to time. So, when we do that, we assume immediately that our waves are harmonic and monochromatic fields. What do we mean by that? That basically means that we're just basically working with one color, say red, one frequency, because we just have one frequency component there. And if we just want to look at the frequency components, frequency spectrum, our frequency will have just one frequency component there. It's a rather basic simplification for harmonic monochromatic fields, but it's really helpful. Let's try to see how it comes handy. Okay, the Maxwell's equations again. Let's plug that in. And another tip. Well, these cross products here, they're actually just derivatives. They can be thought of as derivatives in special coordinates. Once we do that, once we solve this derivative to derivative equation, then these are the answers, the solutions of those equations. The electric field is expressed in terms of the time and the spatial domain in two different components. And immediately, the intensity is equal to the square of it. Okay. This solution is the most simplest one that you can ever get, and it's the expression for the plane waves, and that's the one we're going to use. Okay, if we know the Euler's formula, which implies that e to the x is equal to cosine x plus j sine x, then it follows that the real part of this expression is basically just the cosine part. And then we call this part the phase term. As I told you, these are plane waves, and they have planar wavefronts. What do we mean by that? We call this as the phase term here, kr minus omega t. Okay, we can even simplify this further. Let's take t equals 0 for the simplest case. When we do that, we can just forget about this part, and it just gives us kr. So the amplitudes, the same amplitudes in the special domain, will give us a plane wavefront. And this is represented here as a planar wavefront. And this is our wave vector then, k. And that also shows us the propagation direction of light. And that also giving us the propagation direction of the energy of light. So energy is propagating in this direction, just like the energy, the wave packet. And you might remember from high school, this whole thing, the electromagnetic wave, E and H and K, that's a right-handed system. You can basically show it with your right hand. But of course, the waves may not be always this simple. Here is a spherical wave. Its wavefronts are spherical, as the name implies. The K, the wave vector, will always be perpendicular to the wavefronts. In this case, perpendicular to these circles. And as you can see, the wave is just diverging in all these directions rather than a certain direction, which might be a certain axis for the planar waves. Okay, so here are the basic equations that we will be using. So our wave vector K is defined as omega over C. Well, we can define it like that as long as we're in vacuum. And C here is the speed of light. And it's also expressed in terms of the epsilon zero and mu zero that we talked about. And it's almost equal to 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. The velocity of light in a bulk medium, something that is different than a vacuum, will be this in the most general expression. We have mu r and epsilon r, as you can see. And it makes sense. Why? Because if you switch to another medium that has a different relative permittivity, bigger than 1, the light's velocity, the phase velocity, will decrease down. So normally, the multiplication of the permeability and permittivity, relative permeability and relative permittivity, and the square root of it will give you n, the refractive index of the medium, which you might be familiar with. In most of the cases, this mu r, especially the materials that we are investigating, will be equal to 1, and that makes n equals square root of epsilon r, almost. Okay. Now we will be starting to talk about the dispersion lines. A dispersion line is a relationship between the omega and the k. For bulk materials, it's pretty simple. It's just a linear relationship. In the previous slide, we already covered that k is equal to omega over c. Then, the slope of this line will be equal to c for vacuum. When we're talking about vacuum, light travels with a speed of c, and then that will give us this. So it has a high slope. Nothing can travel faster than light, so that will have the highest slope. Okay, let's think about different materials. Zinc oxide, for example. Zinc oxide has a relative permittivity of almost 4, at least in a certain wavelength spectrum. And then if we try to write the velocity of light in zinc oxide, it's going to be C over square root of epsilon r, which makes it basically C over 2. So, eventually, our slope will be sacrificed. We'll have a different slope than the airline slope. It's going to be smaller than the airline slope in vacuum. If we go to another absorber, amorphous silicon, and if we just assume that epsilon r is equal to almost 16, of course, you can see that the slope is even reduced more. So now, in this case, let's talk about the switch between a spatial domain and a k-vector space. Okay, let's imagine that these are planar waves traveling in spatial domain. And, yeah, they're going in this direction. And k makes an angle between z and x-axis. And, of course, a distance between two planar wavefronts is equal to lambda. So this is the case in spatial domain. And let's switch it to k-space. Then, rk, the propagation of light, was in this direction. And I told you it had an angle between the k and the kx, the x-axis, which was theta. So this will be basically k times sine theta. But what's going to happen if this k will be projected here? It's going to be something like this, right? And let's go even further. We can project it all along. This will give us basically a circle. For bulk materials, all of the available k vectors will reside inside the circle. And this circle is called isofrequency contour. Okay, so here is the three-dimensional dispersion expression. In three dimensions, it looks more like this. In the third axis, we will have energy or omega. Energy, let's remind ourselves, is just another expression of omega. It can be related to omega. And the isofrequency contours that we just worked with are just cross-sections taken from this cone. At the zero frequency, of course, it's going to go down to zero because this is directly related to omega. If omega is zero, then at zero frequency, k vector should be also going to zero. And if we take two different cross-sections, we'll arrive at two different isofrequency contours at two different frequencies or energies. This is the case for the bulk materials, isotropic bulk materials. Okay, let's keep the expression for planar waves in our minds, and let's try to see how light is absorbed in such material. We already covered this. So instead of the vacuum, now I'm switching C with V, which is a little different than C. As you can see, we will be just C over N. The speed of light in a certain medium will be divided by N, the refractive index of that medium, and we'll arrive at that general expression. If, of course, the medium that we are propagating inside is vacuum, then N will be 1. And just like we covered, N is related to epsilon in that fashion. But we always talked about simpler cases when epsilon is 4 or 16. What happens when epsilon r, the relative permittivity, is something complex, a complex number? Then, this will make it a little different. The square root of it will be expressed in terms of complex numbers, as you might guess. So, the epsilon r will be related to complex numbers. The square root of it will give us complex numbers. In the literature, these are given as the n and k values for each material, but we already dedicated k as our wave vector and n as our symbol for the refractive index, so I will just put primes here to make a distinction. Here is another material, AZO, and let's take a look at the dispersion curves of this. Here is epsilon r, the real part, and the imaginary part here. As you can see, they change a lot. This material has a quite large imaginary part in the UV part, UV spectrum, which is from 300 to 400 nanometers in terms of wavelength. And it starts to decrease all the way down in the visible range, that's starting from 400 going up to 700, almost has zero imaginary part that makes it transparent. So in that part, this will be zero, and all we're going to be caring about will be the real part of the dispersion curve. What I mean by that is the dispersion, real part of the permittivity, relative permittivity. Okay, that was just the case for one material. Now, let's just assume that our propagation is along x. So, kr gets a much more simpler form. K, as we covered in the previous slide, is expressed like that. And the special domain is just has just one component, so we can express it in the following way. And instead of n this time, let's plug in this expression that we covered in the previous slide, which is a complex value. And then we'll put it into our general expression for the planar waves here. When we do that, this part will stay to remain the same, but in this part, as you can see, this j will be multiplied with this j, and it won't give just a phase term here that can be easily expressed as cosine or sine. But instead, it will have a real number. So this part cannot be expressed in terms of Euler's formula, and that won't bring a phase term. Instead, it will bring a decaying term. As you can see, as x gets bigger, the fields are bound to decay. How? Like this. E to the minus alpha x. So that's how light is absorbed inside the material. And if we go to the intensity, if we take the square of that, we arrive at the point that 2 is now 4. And that's like always mentioned as the absorption coefficient. Alpha is shown as the absorption coefficient. And as you can see, we can relate alpha to k prime there. Okay, now let's cover a different case for a different material. This is a real absorber. This is crystalline silicon. And that's the real part of the permittivity and the imaginary part. As you can see, it also has relatively high imaginary parts between 300 and 400, but unlike AZO, its absorption, imaginary part still exists, continue to exist in the part in the visible region from 400 to 700, actually goes up to 1000, even though it gets really small. So, the intensity, the light that's coming from the sun, will start to be absorbed inside this material, the absorber material. And as you can see, the intensity will go down. Alright, so there are two things that we're concerned about when we're talking about solar cells. Light comes from the sun, but two unwanted things can happen. We have to struggle with the reflections at the top surface and the transmission here, which is going to bring the leakage outside of the system. Well, if your absorber is quite strong, your transmission will be relatively small, but still you have to tackle this reflection at the top. And absorption is then defined as this, 1 minus R minus T, as you would expect. The absorbed portion is the portion that is remained from when we subtract the reflected parts together with the transmitted parts. Okay, so here is the normalized solar spectrum of the sun, and this is it shows us the strength of the sun's power that is transmitted through atmosphere, and that's reaching us. So as you can see, the UV part is rather small, and it's bad for human beings, and the atmosphere is actually playing for our advantage. This is the part that is transmitted the most, the visible part. And I told you, this starts from almost 400 nanometers, goes up to 700 nanometers or so. And the rest is called near infrared. Well, our eyes are evolved so that we will make the most out of this visible spectrum. And those are the colors that we identify. Okay. If we take a small integral of this here, the absorption, and as a function of lambda, wavelength, and multiply it with this phi. Phi is this solar intensity graph, as I've shown you. From 300 nanometers, we start adding all the contributions of this multiplication of the absorption coefficient with this weight function here. From 300 nanometers, the edge of the cutoff, to the cutoff wavelength for the absorber, that will be specific for the absorber, we arrive at the definition of the short circuit current. That will be useful for in our next lecture. Okay. So you will ask me, what is the cutoff wavelength? This is approximately the cutoff wavelength for amorphous silicon. And it's around, amorphous silicon, it's around 800 nanometers. And that's the cutoff wavelength for crystalline silicon. And it is extended beyond even 1000 nanometers, as you can see. All right, now let's start discussing reflection and refraction. And what do we mean by that? So, our incoming light is coming at an angle, theta, from epsilon 1 medium, emerging at epsilon 2 medium. Immediately, we will have a transmission component and a reflection component. All of these components have two other components themselves. So, they have a normal component and a tangential component. The tangential part will be the important part for us. I won't bother you with the details of it, but the Maxwell's equations at the boundary imply that the tangential components must be reserved. So the tangential components must add up to each other. What do we mean by that? The incident wave, the reflected wave, and the transmitted wave are expressed like this. If you see, this is nothing else but the planar wave that we covered in the previous slides with a theta. And the reflected portion is exactly the same. Since it's also staying in epsilon 1 medium, this will stay as k1. The propagation vector will not be changed, in other words, but there will just be an r added to that term. That's the reflection constant coming from this boundary. Likewise, the transmitted field will be multiplied by T. And the rest is almost the same. That's again the planar wave function that we covered. But here, the transmitted field relies inside epsilon 2. So we need to alter this propagation vector K2 from K1. And if we just add up the tangential components, EI, incident wave, reflected wave, and the transmitted wave, and equate them to each other, we see that this equation must be satisfied for all values of this, R and T. The only case that can be satisfied for all R and T is that these phase terms must be equal to each other. So, we will arrive at a very familiar equation for us. Yes, as I told you, all those phase terms must be equal to each other. How can these two be equal to each other? Well, theta and phi must be equal to each other, basically, which implies that whichever angle that you're coming with, you will get a reflection at the same angle. So, phi is equal to theta, basically. On the other hand, this phi on the transmitted side will be also equal to, will be related to theta in the following way. So if you just do the math here, you will arrive at this equation. And that's, yes, that's Snell's law from 17th century. And it has lots of implications just like this. You see that the spoon is rather, the light is getting refracted, and you see these different shapes. Okay, this is another way of visualizing this phenomena in terms of wavefronts. The wavefront is approaching to the interface from, let's say, epsilon 1 to epsilon 2 again. And as I told you, K represents the direction of the energy flow, and it always needs to be perpendicular to the wavefront, expressed like that. So if you're arriving at an angle of this, then the refraction will take place, and with the Snell's law, we have the chance to determine the refracted angle. Of course, there are different types of reflection, specular reflection and diffuse reflection. Specular reflection, we all covered this. We said that this theta will be equal to this. But of course, in diffuse reflection, there will be all of these terms coming from the roughness of the surface. And if you just think that we have a general wave coming here, a planar wavefront, it will just be scattered into different tiny components like this and that. And as you might appreciate, the outgoing theta angle will not be equal to the incoming angle. Okay, so there's another way of visualizing all this refraction phenomena in terms of isofrequency contours. So again, we switch to K-space instead of the spatial domain. All right, this, let's say, the isofrequency contour of the fast medium. What do I mean by fast medium? Well, I'm automatically assuming that epsilon 1 will be smaller than epsilon 2. Hence, the velocity of light in epsilon 1 medium will be bigger than the velocity of light in epsilon 2 medium. Okay, that was the isofrequency contour for the fast medium. That's for the slow medium, epsilon 2. Again, we're coming with an angle theta here. Let's try to see the tangential component of that K vector. The green one is the incident wave. And then we will have the opportunity to get our construction line. So this needs to be drawn from the center to the place where we intersect with the isofrequency contour for the fast medium. And since the tangential component of K will be conserved, the construction line will dictate that this will be the secondary intersection point. And from the origin again to the isofrequency contour of the slow medium, we have a different angle, phi. And hence, we again have the chance to sort out the and relate theta to phi using geometry in these circles. Okay. How can we minimize the reflection? Well, nature already accomplishes it in Mott's eye. This is Mott's eye under scanning electron microscope. As you can see, there are all these pillar-like shapes in Mott's eye, and it minimizes the reflection. That's what we also want in solar cells. So, as we always do, we mimic the nature's ways, and we construct these small pillars in nanoscale so that we will have small absorption in figure 16. All right. So let's work on this case. Again, bearing in mind the phenomenon of reflection. We have a small thin oxide, another layer, on top of the absorber here for the flat case. Preserving the same thickness for the absorber here, if we just make a nanodome out of this, we can also tackle the problem of the reflection and get minimized reflection here. So the arrows represent the magnitude of reflection. As you can see, from this flat layer, we will have a rather large reflection going up. Instead, the reflections will be minimized by using these nanodomes. They're pretty similar to, especially this one is pretty similar to the case for Moth's Eye. Of course, there's another thing happening when we have these. You have the chance to scatter the light. Once you scatter the light, you just deliver it to the next pillar here. And once then the light is bound to get inside of this absorber again. So there's this thing. It will be absorbed first here by this pillar and scattered partially to the next pillar. So hence you will have more absorption and less reflection. Another thing, when the light emerges to these nanopillars, nanodomes, then it might have a chance to get focused here. As you can see, the light is rather focused inside these nano lenses, just like the magnifying glass experiment. All right. So let's talk about Fabry-Pérot phenomena and the Fabry-Pérot resonances. Let's assume that light is coming from this direction here, from epsilon 1 medium, and we have our first boundary at x equals 0. It will be reflected. And this is the reflection. That's the transmission designated with number 3. So let's try to see the expressions for that. In terms of the planar waves that we covered, well, the most general formula for the planar wave, omitting the time part, is this. So if you just think that x equals 0 at this boundary, this will go away and we will just have this E0. Some part of it will be reflected back. And then in order to find that portion, we will need to multiply the incoming light with R1, the reflection coefficient from epsilon 1 to epsilon 2 medium. Okay, there's just one change here that I made. I put a plus sign here. Why? Because in this case, light is going in the opposite direction. This time, K is in this direction. So we need to be careful about that. When it changes its direction, we need to make that sign change as well. Again, at x equals 0, it will be just R1 times E0. Likewise, T1 will be coming into picture, and it will multiply the incident wave function to get the transmitted wave. At x equals 0, it just boils down to this simple formula. Again, if you pay attention, I switch from K1 to K2 in order to represent the wave vector in the epsilon 2 medium. Okay, let's say that 3 is traveling and getting to x equals t from x equals 0 point. When that happens, let's call 3 as 3 prime. 3 prime, after propagating a distance of t, will be equal to this. It was originally this, 3 was equal to this, and it will just be multiplied by this phase term. And that's just coming from the plane wave expression again. And that 3 prime will be reflected back in terms of 4 and will be transmitted outside, and it's shown as 5. Let's also write down the formula for those. 4 is equal to, again, reflection coefficient of light that is being reflected back into epsilon 2 is now expressed as R2. It's not R1 because in this case, the light is trying to go from epsilon 2 medium to epsilon 1 medium. In the previous case, it was R1 because the light was coming from epsilon 1 medium. So there's R1 and R2 shortly can be different and will be different. So these will be the expressions for 4 and 5. Likewise, we will not be using T1 because, again, the light is going out from epsilon 2. And let's have number 4 travel that distance again, T distance again. And it will arrive at x equals 0 point, and let's define it as 4 prime. Then 4 prime will be this. After covering this much of distance, minus T this time. Yes, we need to be very careful in terms of signs here, because here x is in positive direction, going from x equals 0 to x equals T. But now in this case, 4 is becoming 4 prime and going in the reverse direction. So in order to have that, to add that phase term, this will be just this, basically. Nothing will be changed, but we will have this additional phase term. And that phase term, in order to express that, first we need to change the sign of the wave vector. Since, again, we are going in the reverse direction, it's going to be a plus. But we covered a distance, a negative distance, minus t. So it's going to bring a minus again. And that 4 prime will be transmitted partially and reflected back in 7. And those are this formula for those. Once you look at these and try to figure out the total reflection, because it's going to be an infinite series, the components number 2 and 6 will be related to the reflection. They're going back to the source. As I told you, there will be infinite amount of reflections, and you can continue writing down those equations. So the total reflection will be the summation of those components, number 2, number 6, and all the others. So it's basically going to be like this. So if you like to write the next term, I wrote it for you. You can derive it for yourself again. So there will always be an additional phase term and another 2J, K2T coming into picture, because the light will bounce from both of the interfaces. And the total thing will be an interference phenomena. As you can see, we have all these waves interfering at the first boundary. So then we should start talking about interference. Here in this picture, you can see that we have two light sources that are rather different from planar waves. Their phase fronts are not planar, but rather spherical. By the way, you can't really have planar waves in the nature, but we are making this abstraction to simplify our equations. And as you can see, at some points we have bright and dark regions as a phenomenon of interference. In some points, the summation of those two waves will cancel out each other, destructive interference, and at some points they will just enhance each other and will create bright areas. Likewise, if we try to find the Fabry-Perot resonances for this simple slab, here's the spectrum of transmission and reflection. So there are these peak points in transmission graph. So at 320, 400, and 533 nanometers, transmission makes a peak. Likewise, when transmission makes a peak, reflection will be minimized. So this was the transmission and reflection spectrum for a slab of this and a medium with epsilon equals 4 surrounded by air on both sides. So as you can see, in the first case we are at 356 nanometer. That was a reflection peak, and as you can see, we have lots of reflection here. In contrast, at 400 nanometer, we have lots of transmission on this side and minimized reflection on this side, almost none. Well, that was a transmission peak after all. And let's try to see what's happening inside this slab. Well, the light emerges and covers this distance, this trail, and goes back. If we say that, they will constructively interfere. What do I mean by that? This phase term, this additional phase term, will come into picture. We'll need to multiply it by 2. And that makes 2k2t. And let's say that at this boundary again, they will constructively interfere. What do I mean by that? The total phase term will be at 2 pi and its constants. Why am I saying that? Because when we write minus j 2 pi, this will be equal to 1. So this will be a constructive interference. Likewise, if we had minus j pi, this would be minus 1. And this would be a destructive interference. So these two terms are now getting added up because we equated it to a multiple number of 2 pi. If we wanted a destructive interference, then we should have equated to pi instead of 2 pi. Okay, when we do that, we arrive at this equation, the simple equation. Of course, we are assuming a very simple case here without losses. And when we know this N2, it's 2 basically, and we know the thickness, it's 400. When we insert the numbers and play around with this integer value to find out the Fabry-Perry resonances, the transmission peaks, they will be exactly at these wavelengths that we covered in the last slide. Okay, so this interference phenomenon is quite helpful for solar cells. Let's say that this is our solar cell here. If we add an additional thin layer, just like the one we covered in the previous slides, we called it a TCO, transparent conductive oxide. If we add a small layer, even though it might be thin in terms of its thickness, it might minimize the reflections, and that's something we want. How can it minimize the reflections? If we arrange that its thickness is equal to lambda over 4, that's called quarter wave matching, then this wave that's immediately getting reflected back from the first interface, and this one getting reflected back, they will destructively interfere with each other, and that will minimize the reflections. Okay, just let's take a look at this. Let's say that the second wave will cover two times the thickness of this small TCO. That brings us minus J 2 pi over lambda times N. As we said, this is our K vector, and that will cover 2 times the thickness of the layer. But of course, it needs to be multiplied. It needs to be this wave vector, the lambda must be scaled with the refractive index as well. These n's are the refractive indices of this thin oxide. And once we do this algebra, these will go, the lambda will go, and 2, 2, 4 will go. As you sort out, it will just make 2... It will just make minus j pi. And as I told you in the previous slide, it will bring a minus 1. So these two will destructively interfere at the first boundary. Okay, so researchers make use of this in real life. This is the reflection coming from just bare silicon. If we put glass on top of silicon, the reflections are getting decreased up to some extent. But also, if we add a quarter wavelength matching layer on top of that glass layer, and that's called ARC, by the way, anti-reflection coating in abbreviations, with the wanted refractive index. So the reflections can be minimized at certain points, like 600 nanometers in this case. This is an advantage, but there's also a disadvantage of the ARCs, the anti-reflection coatings, based on quarter wavelength matching. As you can see, they are very bandwidth limited. If you move a little further, that nice zero reflection will not be sustained. Okay, so we covered the phenomena when light emerges from the top. Standing waves are formed inside in a slab. But what happens when light comes from the other side? Then there is the opportunity that the light will be guided by the slab. There will be reflection phenomena coming into picture. Some of the waves will be refracted outside, but some will be having a rather large theta, the incoming angle, and they will be totally internally reflected. And we know that that's called total internal reflection. For those cases, those theta angles, the light will be guided along this direction. Yeah, we have light guiding. And this is a figure representing that guiding. So let's say that we have an epsilon equals 16 case, a small slab with a thickness of 200 nanometer surrounded by air. This is the dispersion dispersion line for the modes for those distinct theta angles. The theta angles, let's say, call it theta 1, and let's call this one theta 2. There might be all these different modes that are traveling inside the slab with different angles of reflection coming from the boundary between epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. As you see, these are not straight lines, but a little bit complicated than that. So we still have our light line here. That's the general expression that we covered in the previous slides. And this will be the light line for the slab this time. So this is basically governed by omega over C equals K. This will be governed by omega over C K. Since the refractive index, or in other words, the relative permittivity of the slab is smaller, this slope is getting reduced with respect to air line again. So we have all these different lines inside. Those are the dispersion curves of the waves that are traveling inside. Since they are not plane waves anymore, they are a little different. They don't have this simple line expression. And let's take a look at the two cases, 450 terahertz and 300 terahertz. So these are the waves that are propagating inside at those frequencies. This is rather the combination of several waves there. Let's go back one slide and let me clarify what I mean by that. As you can see, at 300 terahertz, there are two modes available. The light intersects with 300 terahertz at two points. For 450 terahertz, on the other case, we have three intersection points, and the interference of these two and three modes, three waves, in other words, will give us these patterns here. As you can see, the light is really guided inside and the leakage is small. Why do we have the leakage so small? Well, let's take a look at this picture here. Let's say that the light is traveling inside the slab with a tangential component of K2 parallel. And the light that is outside the slab will have a tangential component of K1 parallel. Well, in all cases, the K1 parallel maximum will need to be equal to K2 parallel maximum. As I told you in the previous investigations, the tangential component of the wave vector must be reserved. But if we have that, if we have K1 parallel equal to K2 parallel, the maximum K that that air can support, let's say K1 max, and let's subtract it from K2 parallel, that will be the propagation vector in this direction, in the Z direction. As you can see, since K1 max is smaller than this parallel vector here, our propagation direction in this along Z axis will be an imaginary number. And once that is an imaginary number, it will just be treated as in the case of absorbers. It will just get decreased. There will be a decay. So outside of the wave guide, the lights will, there will be a leakage, but it's going to get terminated soon. Another way of seeing this is the K component here, K2 parallel, is rather big. Outside of this, we must have K1 parallel. Since those are all same, equal to each other, the K1 max that air can supply is rather small. As you can see, this does not make a real perpendicular triangle. What I mean by that is, normally K1 max should have been bigger than the parallel component for a valid KZ component. Okay, let's move on to diffraction phenomena. We have these slits. What happens if we have openings, if we have a discontinuity along the reflection surface? Then, from these apertures, we will have all these waves coming out. As you can see, let's just take into consideration these two, one and two. One will cover this much of distance more than number two, the ray number two. So that will bring an additional phase term. The subtraction of two, phi 1 minus phi 2, since 1 will be ahead in terms of phase in contrast to 2, let's try to find out what that is equal to. Of course, the light will travel that much of distance. K times L will give us the phase difference, the propagation constant times the traveled space. We know that this propagation constant is equal to this, and delta L will sort it out. It's just basically D times sine theta. If you do small geometrical trick here, then if we plug that in and equate it to 2 pi m, again to give a constructive interference at a point, let's say that we have an observer here and we want this number 1 and number 2 rays constructively interfere, we need to equate the phase term, the additional phase term, to 2 pi m, because the rest will be exactly the same. What I mean by that is, from this point on, number 1 and number 2, these two rays will cover the same distance to an observer at infinity. But there will be an additional this much of space, phase term, coming for ray number one. So we create these, we arrive at this expression. So the angle of diffraction is given by this. It's a collective action, actually. As you see, all of these rays are getting constructively interfered at an for an observer at infinity. Okay, let's put our light source here. And then let's eliminate the structure. What are those structures? They're basically scatterers in air. They're tiny spheres in air, and they have a relative permittivity of 9. Well, even if they had a different relative permittivity, things wouldn't change much. What happens? When we launch the wave towards these scatterers, the scatterers diffract the incoming wave into different components, and these are represented with these arrows. These are the reflected modes, and those are the outgoing modes. They are basically defining different diffraction orders. So let's try to collect those modes with a monitor placed here, and let's investigate these two cases. At 400 nanometer, D equals 1000 nanometer. D is the spacing between these two scatterers, by the way. And at another wavelength, the spacing is same. We only have the wavelength increased a little. We arrive at these diffraction orders. This first one is called zeroth order. Since we were coming to the scatterers at normal incidence, that normal incidence will be transmitted up to some degree, and its power will be distributed to these other orders, like the first order, the second order. And when we go to a higher wavelength, as you see, we lose some number of those diffraction peaks, diffraction modes, in other words, totally available number of modes will be decreased. But nevertheless, we still see the first order here. We don't see the second order, but we still see the first order. And the angles that these modes arrive at the monitor are given by our simple calculation that we sorted out in the previous slide for the diffraction, for the constructive interference. So these two things, they support each other. These are the numerical simulations, and that was the formula that we found for the diffraction, constructive interference for diffraction, was coming basically from wavefront analogy, and these two give us the same results. For example, the numerical simulation says that our diffracted mode will appear at 44 degrees, whereas our simple equation that we covered two slides back gives us a value of 44.42 degrees. So, again, using this small and simple formula, we can work at different spacings. Now we increase it up to 1400 nanometers, 1400 nanometers. So we basically increase the spacing between the scatterers. What happens? Then, if we increase this, of course, the sine theta will get dropped down. So I'm just giving a number. Instead of, let's say, 20 degrees for the first order, we now have 10 degrees for the first order. That enables something. If we increase the separation of these modes, then we will have more number of modes available. Why? Because sine theta the maximum angle that we can have will be 90 degrees. If we have a chance to get a smaller separation, then we will have more number of modes. And likewise, we see the appearance of the third order mode here. that we lacked in the previous slides. And again, likewise, if we decrease this number here, the separation between the scatterers, as you can see, for 700 nanometers, we have no diffracted modes, just the zeroth order diffraction or the transmission itself. And here we just see the first order diffraction. Okay, let's make a trick. Let's say that in all the previous cases, the scatterers were in air. What do I mean by that? This portion was air, this portion was also air. Let's say that this portion is now covered by a slab that has an dielectric constant of 4. What's going to happen? You can do it by yourself too, but there will only be a term coming into picture here, which is N2, the square root of epsilon 2. And the beauty of that is this way we will be able to get more modes. It's in a way akin to increasing D, the separation distance between the scatterers. So we will have more modes. Let's try to visualize the diffraction phenomena at an incident angle rather than just normal angle of incidence. So our phase fronts are approaching those scatterers. As you can see, we have an angle of phi here, incoming wave fronts. In this case, wavefront 1 covered a smaller distance in contrast to wavefront 2. So, as you see, wavefront number 2 is ahead of wavefront number 1. And let's define it as the phase difference at the input side, delta phi e. That is the difference between these two wavefronts. And that's basically equal to K1, the wave vector in this side, times this distance covered. And that's equal to D times sine phi. And let's take a look at the outgoing wavefronts. We just covered this in the previous slides. In this case, one will propagate more and will get additional phase terms in contrast to 2. So 1 will be ahead of 2 this time. And let's define the phase difference between two wavefronts as delta phi o. This case, K2 times d times sine theta will be the phase difference. And that's the phase difference between the first wavefront minus the second wavefront. So we have a different situation here. In the input side, the second wavefront was ahead of the first wavefront, but at the output side, the first wavefront is ahead of the second wavefront. And we have different phase, additional phase terms coming in the picture. So what should we do? Basically, we should just make a subtraction between these two phase differences. And we must equate them to 2 pi m again. For what? For constructive interference, for obvious reasons that we covered in the previous slides. When we do that, we arrive at this equation. That's a beautiful equation. Why? It shows us one thing. Let's say that we arrive at K1 sin phi to a boundary with an angle of phi. Our outgoing, the tangential component, will be of course K1 sine phi. That, we have a chance to modulate that. We have a chance to increase this tangential components with multiple integers of this term here, and at the output side it will be equated to K2 sine theta. The beauty of this is more obvious for normal incidence. Let's say that we are coming at normal incidence. We have no tangential component at all in this case. But as you see, even though this is zero, we still have an additional phase tangential component. and it's equal to 2 pi md. This is beautiful. This is like converting the energy flow of the input, the normal light, into these tangential components. And it will be very useful in light trapping in the next lecture. And we can visualize this again with our isofrequency contours. Let's say that this is the isofrequency contour for the first medium, the fast medium. Kx and Kz square will give us K1 square as expected. And let's say that this is the isofrequency contour. The red one is the isofrequency contour for the slow medium with an epsilon 4 or n equals 2 in the other at the exit side. So likewise, we need to preserve the tangential component of the K vector at the interface, and we already did this part in the while we were investigating the refraction phenomena. But what's going to change with the addition of diffraction, the scatterers? Then, from this point on, we have a chance to excite the other modes as well. Here we see the first m equals 1, the first diffraction order that is separated by a distance of 2 pi d. And let's add another 2 pi d, because as you remember, two slides ahead, we said that the separations will be added by multiple integers of 2 pi over d. So if we go 4 pi d, we will have the second diffraction order at the exit side. But that is outside of the available K space, the isofrequency contour of the slow medium, epsilon 2, and it's not crossed by the isofrequency contour. And then we do not have that mode. That's a minus sign representing the absence of that mode. But we have the first order, the negative minus first order, and we also have the minus 2, the negatively diffracted second order available that can be covered by the isofrequency contour. Here's the numerical investigation. We carried out the electromagnetic simulation of this. We have our scatterers at this boundary. Light is coming with an angle of 30 degrees here at a spacing of 700 nanometers. And we have the emergence of these different modes. Well, this is obviously the zeroth order itself. And that's the plus first order, minus first order, minus second order. As you can see, we don't have the plus second order again. And the angles, once again, determined by this very simple formula, are equal to the results of the numerical simulation. Okay, so we investigated different scenarios. When light is guided, when light is coming up from this top direction. But what happens if we stack different epsilon material one after another and let light come from the side? Okay, this is one of those scenarios. When we have that, the nice nice dispersion lines that were available for the bulk material will no longer be available. What I mean by that is our dispersion curves, dispersion lines will not be lines anymore, but they will have these different features. So we have the emergence of a filter now. What do I mean by that? So within this frequency range, the light will be transmitted to the other side. By the way, these are called photonic crystals. And in this case, we're investigating a one-dimensional photonic crystal. So we have an emergence of a transmission band here. The light is transmitted all the way to the exit side. And likewise, we have another transmission region, and the third one, fourth one, goes like this. But between these transmission regions, we have the forbidden regions. In these forbidden regions, light is not allowed to propagate. This is something new. We never saw that before for bulk material. Okay, there might be reflections coming from fabric-parallel reflections, but we still had a certain amount of transmission. The transmission could be very small at a certain point, but still we would have a transmission. But when we stack these different slabs, these reoccurring slabs, and alternate the dielectric distribution, we have these forbidden bands appearing in our simulations. And this can also show itself in the dispersion curve as well. So along this curve, we have all the modes available that the light can be coupled into. And likewise, this is another band that the light can couple to. Number 3 is here, number 4 is here. But between these two, like here, and there, here, we again have the absence of the dispersion curve. So there is no K corresponding to a omega or frequency here in this graph. So light cannot be supported within that frequency region. And that also gives us the same forbidden band. So the edges here are coinciding with the edges here. These are two different calculations. This is just a transmission. This is covering the transmission part. And this is covering the dispersion, the available modes inside the photonic crystal. So what happens if we make it a two-dimensional crystal? And what happens if we have a periodic structure in all in X and Y on the same plane rather than a one-dimensional photonic crystal? Then light can emerge from two directions, from both X and Y. Okay, we can define a square lattice here because this is a square lattice periodicity. Let's say that these have an N equals 3 and the surrounded by air, the separation between the two spheres here, or the cylindric rods, let's say, are equal to 1,400 nanometers. Then we will have the electric field propagating in this fashion. So this was the nice propagation for the bulk material. We already showed that they had the very well-known planar wavefronts, planar plane wave expressions. Very trivial. But in this case, everything gets complicated. Why? Okay. Because the epsilon, the dielectric function itself, is periodic. Epsilon r is equal to epsilon r plus l. With certain periodicity, we will always arrive at the same cylinder, or the portion of the cylinder. And hence, the Maxwell's equations dictate that if epsilon here is periodic, the electric field must also be periodic, like that. In order to achieve this, we need to have this. We need to have another modulation function here, UR, that was absent in this formulation, in the expression for the plane waves, times the time part, that's exactly the same, plus this part. Okay, you might say that this is already periodic for the plane wave. True, but this has nothing, no information about the periodicity of these guys, the spheres here. We need to express that, and we need to modify our wave functions accordingly. So that function is also periodic and expressed like that. And this, in this case, the electric field becomes periodic, and it's called a Bloch wave. unlike this one here, this is just the periodicity of the sine and cosine functions. As you can see, this in this case for the photonic crystal, the propagation is periodic, but it obeys the periodicity of the medium itself. So if we wait for a while, this kind of an electric field distribution here, and it emerges again. So as I told you, this is different from the case in bulk material. We have Bloch functions inside. Okay, let's try to see. Let's switch from the spatial domain to case space again. So going back once again, we see that instead of lambda here, which was a function of the wavelength, now here we need to have something that can be expressed in terms of L, this distance between two rods. And since we have this altered in the wave function, we will have a definition of a Brillouin zone. The Brillouin zone in K-space is the smallest available zone that is repeated to have the total lattice itself. But there is also the irreducible Brillouin zone too. If you just fold it, you can see that you can have the express the Brillouin zone in terms of irreducible Brillouin zone as well. So if we take a look at this, we see that the distance between these two, minus pi over L to pi over L, makes 2 pi over L. And that was the periodicity for the K vector. So it's not a big surprise there to have the reciprocal lattice vector 2 pi over L covering the edges of the Brillouin zone. So all we need to do is to investigate this irreducible Brillouin zone. The corners of that zone is starting from 0, 0, 0, going up to x pi over L to 0 and to the endpoint pi over L, pi over L. So if we try to find out the dispersion curve this time, we need to scan our crystal from x gamma to x point to m point and then to gamma point. And you might remember we have seen these light lines. They were just linear curves. We have also seen those modes available in waveguides. They had curvatures as well. But in the case of photonic crystals, we have a different phenomena. We have, again, the appearance of these modes, forbidden zones. For example, here, once again, just like we've seen for the one-dimensional case, the photonic crystal is not allowing the light propagation. And we have the appearance of multiple number of modes. Gets a little bit more complicated in contrast to the one-dimensional photonic crystal. And as a result, at different wavelengths, we can either block the incoming wave or get it transmitted to the other side. At some wavelengths, the coupling to the Bloch waves, the electric fields inside, will be worse than the other cases. Okay. So that finalizes our discussions regarding the photonic crystals. Let's move on with plasmonics. Normally, metallic layers are acting like perfect mirrors. Well, what do I mean is that if you have an incident wave here, almost all of it will be reflected back. And that is sustained by the high conductivity of the metals. The electrons will not allow light propagation into the metal. And there will be almost no penetration of light or the electromagnetic wave. In contrast, at smaller wavelengths, when light emerges to this metal, of course, the metal has an electron cloud on its outmost surface. This incoming light will interact with this cloud wave, and that will form a wave, another wave, surface plasma and polariton. Those surface plasma and polaritons are composed of the electron cloud and also the light, in the incoming light itself. The surface plasma and polariton is attached to the metal interface here, and once we move along the metal into the metal, it's decaying, as you can see, and into the air as well. So here's another way of expressing what I just said verbally. In figure 24, we see that silver here as metal is acting as a PEC material, perfect electric conductor. What do I mean by that is, as you can see, the electric field, these are the electric field vectors. The electric field comes and gets reflected back all the way, so we see no action happening inside the metal. But on the other hand, at a smaller wavelength, like, let me say, 600 nanometers, for example, we see that the metal itself interacts with the incoming wave, and no longer, it's not immune to this incoming wave. So these are the dispersion curves for two metals. The blue one is for the silver, and the red one is for the gold. So you can see that metals have a rather different dispersion curve. The real part of the dispersion, the dielectric function, gets minus values. But at some point, it crosses the zero point, and it crosses zero earlier for gold. What happens when it crosses zero point? Well, something very familiar happens. This is the one that's related to the loss, if you remember, the imaginary part of the dielectric function. Well, we have something positive, a positive imaginary part, and also something small but still positive on the real part. So it basically becomes like a dielectric material and allows light propagation for gold. In other words, light can propagate into the gold after this plasma frequency. It's called plasma frequency, the point where it intersects with the zero. For silver, on the other hand, it intersects at a higher frequency. And from this point on, we have a layer that has a positive epsilon real part and a positive imaginary part. It again becomes a dielectric-like material. But till that point, we will see that the metal allows some plasmonic action. Here's what I mean by that. So this is the dispersion curve for the silver. If we think about, and this is the light line, by the way, if you think about that, all the waves that we excite from air will stay here outside of the light cone, light line. In order to come to this and exceed the light cone, we need something. And if you remember what we use for that, we use gratings. How did we do that? As we covered in the previous slides, even if we don't have the wanted K parallel, KX in this case, tangential component, we can add to that component 2 pi over d this much, and it's multiple integers, to have it dislocated from this point to a point that will intersect with this. And we can also use prisms as well, and we'll cover this in the next slide. So here are two configurations, and we already talked about this part, the C. When light emerges from here, we have the diffraction orders, and with the help of the diffraction orders, even though we are outside in the light cone, we can jump into the inside of the light cone, and we can intersect the surface plasmon at some point. As you can see, since it's the surface plasma dispersion, since it's below the light line, it cannot go outside of the light line and cannot leak into the air. So that's another way of saying that surface plasmons are just attached to the metal. It cannot leak away. It cannot radiate. Likewise, we can achieve this with prism. So let's say that we are here again. Using the prism, we will have different curvatures, theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, depending on the angle of incidence. And we can again jump into the air cone and excite the surface plasma. After exciting the surface plasma, here's again what happens. We have something that we can couple to. And light is just, what it means basically is that light can penetrate into the, those available modes inside the metal, and will die out, of course, due to the absorption of the metal, but it will, it won't excite the surface plasma polaritons anymore because we can excite it from outside of the air cone. Okay, so we here come to the intersection point of plasmonics and mice scattering. This is a famous glass from Roman times. If we illuminate it from the outside part, we see it a greenish color. But if we illuminate from the inside, we see that the glass has a reddish color. So this was a mystery for several ages for people. And recently, we were able to find out that it had something to do with localized surface plasma resonance, which in which we have surface plasma polaritons playing a dominant role. Well, the Romans were putting gold nanoparticles while they were manufacturing these glasses. And these gold nanoparticles have a spherical feature. When light emerges from this side, they scatter the light in different ways, depending on the dielectric function and the radius of the scatterer, this gold nanoparticle or a silver nanoparticle, depending on what the Romans were putting into these glasses. And we know that this epsilon will vary a lot with in terms of wavelength. For different wavelengths, we will see different epsilon dielectric functions. So the scattering efficiency, in other words, the locations that this gold nanoparticle or silver nanoparticle will scatter, the fractal light will change. And depending on that, it might absorb the incoming light at some point. It might just trap the incoming light, and at some point it might just scatter the light more efficiently for another color, let's say green. And for that, we see it as a green color. So it also depends very much on the incoming angle too. So if we're coming from a different angle, as in the case of this different colorization, if we come from inside, if from a different angle, from the outside, it also changes its color and the scattering efficiency is altered. So if we go to mice scattering, these spheres do not have to be just metal particles. If we have metal particles, we can talk about localized surface plasma resonances inside the metal spheres, nanospheres. But if we have dielectric spheres, we can call them mice scattering in a broader expression, in a broader definition. Mice expressed the diffraction or the scattering coming from these nanospheres analytically, and he found out that there might be lots of things taking action. Like we can have the reflections, The second reflections, as you can see, refractions, diffractions, all these things can happen. And this will also be important for our solar cells. But the incoming light might also be trapped by the by these dielectric spheres, nanospheres. Well, my scattering is defined, we call it scattering, my scattering, when the interacting light has a wavelength in terms of the radius of this. If it's smaller than that, if the radius is much smaller than the incoming radius, if the wavelength is much smaller than the radius of the sphere, it might be a different type of scattering, like Rayleigh scattering. As you can see, we have the scattering phenomena represented here. For smaller particles, we have a broader scattering going to different angles. For a large particle, on the other hand, we have a pretty well-defined scattering in a certain predefined direction. Once again, so the light might be scattered, but also can be encapsulated by these scatterers, and that's what we call my resonance. Thank you very much for listening to me, and we will move on to lecture 2 from this point.